Cheryl Crocher, and you're listening to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. Next time you check into Amazon.com, look up the latest book by Sun Kwok. It's turning into a global bestseller for this University of Calgary astronomer. And technology commercialization just got a boost from the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research. The agency recently announced a mentorship program to help researchers succeed as entrepreneurs. And it's helping hands across the sea as economists and ecologists from the University of Alberta journey to China to replant trees along the banks of the Yangtze River. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. To the naked eye, space is a dark and lonely expanse. But through the lens of the Hubble Space Telescope, it takes on an ephemeral glow, graced by objects of surprising colors. This is what astronomer Sun Kwok from the University of Calgary has captured in his new book, Cosmic Butterflies, The Colorful Mysteries of Planetary Nebulae. These are stars in the final throes before death, a fate our own sun will face one day.
Well, with our human eye, we probably won't see these beautiful colors, but they are very beautiful, colorful objects. They're much more colorful than typical stars or galaxies, and for a very interesting reason, because most of the stars, like our sun, for example, they radiate in all colors, and so taken together, by adding all the colors from red to blue, you have appearance of white, which is not particularly spectacular, but these planetary nebulae are objects which don't radiate continuously. They radiate more like neon signs, and they have specific colors that some radiate strongly in the green, some in the red. So taken together and the different parts of the nebulae, they have extremely rich colors that make them so fascinating as an object to take pictures of.
Now, you have well over 100 pictures in this book. What's your favorite?
Oh, it is very difficult for me to say because there are some personal bias here, because some of the ones that I took myself, I'm more interested in them. But I think one of the objects on the cover, the so-called the Butterfly Nebula, which is part of the reason that the name of the book is a technical name of M29, is one of the most beautiful nebula observed by the Hubble Space Telescope. And there are a number of other ones, like the Cat's Eye, and some of the ones that we discovered and observed ourselves, in particular the so-called Cotton Candy Nebula, the Silkworm Nebula. Those are the ones that we discovered, and therefore we're able to name them. And those are, of course, my personal favorites.
The way you've written this, it's more than just facts and figures about stuff. You're quite a philosopher. What's the emotion for you in writing all of this down?
I think my from my own point of view, I want to tell a story. I want to tell a story how the scientific discovery process works. Because most of the things we learn about the nature and the origin of planetary nebulae really came about in the last 20 and 25 years. And since I was part of this process, and I felt this urge to tell to the public how the discovery process worked, because we have always run into dead ends, wrong ways, and it's not a very straightforward process. And by telling the story how our new knowledge came about, how we ran into problems, and how new, telescopes in space, like the Hubble Space Telescope and the Infrared Space Observatory, these kind of new instruments allow us to explore new grounds. I think that makes an interesting story.
Give me an example. What's one of those dead ends that you ran into?
Oh, there are many. I think it's too numerous for us to talk about here. I mean, there are many. Well, like this shape. I mean, you know, stars are round, right? I mean, the sun is perfectly spherical, But as you can see from a lot of these pictures, a lot of these planetary nebulae have beautiful shapes, and many of them look like butterflies. Some of the major questions among astronomers is how they get to this way. And it's not a simple question to answer, because although they live with a short lifetime, only about 20,000, 30,000 years, and we have to figure out how a star will become a round object to such exotic shape in such a short time. That involves a lot of problems in physics, and which we have to be guided by new observations. And the way that we make progress was by trying to discover objects which cover this transition. We look at objects even on a short time scales of a couple hundred years to see how they change from one stage to another. And over time, we develop some theories on how all this transformation process come about. So one of the chapter is called stellar metamorphosis, and that is the what we try to convey, that this transformation from a star which eventually become a butterfly.
Now, your last chapter deals with some of the newer discoveries. What is it that you're finding out with regard to these nebulae or things that have raised more questions?
Yeah, the planetary nebulae is a very old subject, because the first one was discovered over 200 years ago. And as I mentioned before, we only began to understand their nature in the last 25 years. So most of the focus in the past have been centered on the evolution. I mean, how they were formed, how they change, how they live, and how they die. But more recently, in particular, after the launch of the European satellite called Infrared Space Observatory, we are finding some very astonishing facts about these kind of objects. One of the things is that they produce extremely complicated organic substances at a degree of complexity which is never envisioned by astronomers. And we are now trying to understand the chemical process, how these objects in such a short time, in a matter of thousands of years, are able to synthesize very complex organic molecules. And the fact they are spreading all these molecules into interstellar space makes very interesting speculations on what kind of effect it may have on the galactic environment.
Could this affect our ideas about where life came from?
Well, this is a very interesting and controversial question, because for 50 years, scientists have always thought that life occurred spontaneously on Earth, starting from very simple ingredients like methane or water and ammonia and so on. But now the fact that we are seeing evidence that stars and planetary nebulae in particular are making very complex organic molecules, there's no doubt about that whatsoever, and these things are being spread all over, and we know the solar system was born out of interstellar gas, and it is quite possible that out of the stuff that the sun and the earth and the planets are formed are mixed with a lot of these organic substances. So now he has become a serious subject for us to study whether this cosmic material play any role at all in the development of life on Earth.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Sun Kwok teaches astronomy at the University of Calgary. He has research projects on the Hubble Space Telescope, and he's a Killam Fellow of the Canada Council for the Arts. Cosmic Butterflies is published by Cambridge University Press, and it's available from Amazon.com. It's not enough these days to simply come up with new technologies or scientific breakthroughs. Researchers are now expected to step out of the lab and jump right into the marketplace to commercialize their innovations. But who's got the skills or the stomach for that roller coaster ride? not many, and that's why the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research has developed a new program to nurture the scientist turned entrepreneur. Linda Humphreys explains the need for this business mentorship.
The foundation has spent decades supporting medical researchers in their lab. These medical researchers have as much a desire to have their innovations and the results of their science out in the marketplace, helping people and to improve their lives. To do so, they need to have this commercialized or disseminated by some means. They don't have the skills or the knowledge necessarily that it takes to build the teams in the marketplace that they've built in the lab. Our program is there to help them identify what's needed, how to do that, and to supply support for building those teams.
Now, is it really necessary for researchers and scientists to have to go that far? It's like taking multitasking to the extreme.
It's imperative for researchers to be a part of making that happen. They are the people with the science, with the ideas, and with a very good understanding of how this science might turn into technology that can improve health. Our program, to a great extent, is about defining what has to be done and giving the researcher or the entrepreneur the time and the space to decide what role they want to take in moving it forward.
Have you got anyone in the Forefront program yet?
We definitely have several applicants who have been in the Forefront program. And the Forefront program is actually an umbrella for whatever it is that's needed for the project and for the applicants that are coming forward. So there are people that have taken business plan programs with us, media training. They have received one-on-one mentorship for their intellectual property, for their marketing plans, for their business plans. They've had access to people who help them with how to organize their company or how their company is organized, and a variety of other general good business practices items. So yes, we've had several projects in the Forefront program.
Thank you very much, Linda.
You're welcome. Have an innovative day.
Linda Humphreys is the Vice President of Corporate Affairs and Technology Commercialization with the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research. One of the spin-off companies that has benefited from the Forefront Mentorship Program sports the catchy name DriveAble. Researcher Alan Dobbs is the company's president and founder.
We have an assessment center which looks at how people drive, so we're really interested in looking to see if people are safe to drive. And DriveAble is the name that we chose, and we wanted to emphasize that we hope that people would be able and safe to drive.
Now, right now you're dealing with technology commercialization, but how did this project actually get started? Where does it come from?
It really came from the medical community. We had a research unit at a hospital, and the physicians came down one day and said that they had patients who had mental impairments, either through something like a dementia or heart disease or lung disease or some other kind of illness, and they were still driving. And the question was, how should the doctor make a decision about whether the patient should be told they should continue to drive or maybe they should be thinking about giving up driving? So we thought that we would be able to put some tests together from the literature and that everybody knew how to do driving assessments. And after a lengthy search, it became very clear that there was nothing available that had a science base, that everything that was out there was really best guess and opinion-based. So they said, you're the researchers, and the more we thought about it, the more interesting we thought the problem was. So we shifted our research to looking at how you would assess people's driving ability.
Now, your work has been funded to a certain extent by the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, and the emphasis here is to commercialize your research. What's it been like for you? What kind of a process was that? Were there a few bumps along the way?
Well, first of all, the research itself was funded in large measure by the foundation, and so that got us through the research phases. At the end of the research, it really was a matter of having maybe 100, 150 doctors that were using the evaluation. The Alberta Licensing Authority was using the evaluation. And yet it was still really a research project. And when we finished the research, like all researchers, we said, thank you, we're moving on to another project. And people said, well, you can't. I mean, this is something that's valuable and is providing a service, and we need that service. So through support from the university and support from the foundation, we started to make that shift from research to practice, which is a difficult shift to make, that's for sure. But the technology commercialization program allowed some funding, which allowed us to hire some people that made the transition much easier. There are always bumps along the road. I think the major bump that we've had is that we're trying to change tradition. We're changing tradition from best guess and opinion-based driving evaluation to a science-based evaluation. And that's a tough move to make.
This program, Forefront, what's the importance or value of that?
Well, the importance of the program for us is a mentorship, which helps us to understand who the important people are, to understand how to put things together. I mean, you're starting from nothing, and all of a sudden everybody wants a business plan, and they want all the economic assurances, and they want you to go out and raise your own money. They might provide some funding for you, but clearly you have to go out and get the job done. And coming from a research position where you know how to write research grants, you know how to teach, and you know how to do those kinds of things, it's a very different expertise. And without that kind of mentorship, people just can't make that transition.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Alan Dobbs, president and founder of Drive Able. Coming up, childhood friends team up to restore the beauty of the Yangtze River. It was a lament for the lost splendor of the Yangtze River that brought two boyhood friends together again. One a rocket scientist, the other a biologist. Their collaboration has spawned an international effort to bring economic and ecological prosperity to the banks of the Yangtze once again. Dr. Larry Wong is with the University of Alberta.
About 2 years ago, I have a childhood friend, Dr. Sam Chow, who took a trip with his family to the Three Gorges in China. He was born in China, in Chongqing, like myself was, during the Second World War. So essentially, it was a homecoming trip for him and his family. Now, when he was on the trip through the Yangtze River, he noticed that the Yangtze River was really quite dirty and deteriorated to a state that very different from what I remembered when he was a child and coming out of China to Taiwan. And the slopes along the river on both sides were bare, and they were washed out because the hills were heavily cultivated by agriculture purposes. And all the beautiful sceneries that he remembered and read through the Chinese poems and the literature, they were basically not there. So he was very sad and very taken by the sad state of the river. And right there and then, I think he made a personal commitment that he wished to do something, you know, for the environment and for the homeland. And what he promised himself was to donate his life savings.
How is your friend going to turn this all around?
Well, once he had this idea, he brewed the idea for about a year and may have approached his alma mater, UCLA, in Los Angeles for help. I gather that he wasn't very successful because, you know, most other people probably would think this is such a remote and such a small one-person type of entity may not have much impact without a lot of government and the general public involvement. So about a year or so later after that, he contacted me during a Christmas break when we were in Los Angeles. And basically he asked if University of Alberta could help him to realize his dream of wanting to do something to save the environment. I was touched, of course, by the gesture, and I was touched by the foresight, and I was touched by how somebody wanting to make a difference, you know, as a single person. Quickly, I conversed with President Fraser, and President Fraser at our university immediately thought this was something that was within the mandate of our university being a leader internationally, and being a leader in environmental issues. And the Yangtze River Basin certainly is one of the major environmental concerns of the world.
What about government regulation, though? Because these sorts of things don't change around unless you've got the help of the government in the country where it matters.
Yes, and this is a very good question, because timing is perfect, because after the environmental assessment that the tremendous soil loss would endanger the economic benefit of the Three Gorges Dam, China had a national policy installed, new policy. In other words, no more cultivation on the slopes along the Yangtze River or any other major tributaries if the slope is over 25 degrees.
Now, well, that sounds like a good thing for the land. What about the people? There must be millions of people there who are dependent on farming, not forestry.
Indeed. There are millions of people involved in this case, and several provinces involved. And the government, of course, was quite reasonable. They had a national policy indicating that if you are going to return the land to forest, if the forest will give you economic benefits, like fruit trees, like certain maybe herbal medicinal plants, then the government will fund your grains, your food, for the next 5 years. In other words, a five-year buffer zone, five-year, I guess, continuance, so that you can subsist and waiting for the forest to make you money later on. If you want to plant a non-economic forest, but eco-forests, in other words, forests which will be there for forever, doesn't matter whether it's evergreen or whether it's a mixed forest, they will support the farmer for 8 years. So in other words, there are some national policies to assist the farmers changing from their old ways of living, of farming and so on, into now a living that's sustainable and economically and ecologically sound.
Is that going to be enough for them, though?
I think the economic forest will be probably sustainable. Maybe jumping the gun a little bit, for example, we were able to help one county in the Yunnan province, and we taught the farmers to plant bamboos. Now, Yunnan province is southwest of Sichuan province. You know, Sichuan province is very famous for its panda bears. And Yunnan actually is contiguous with Sichuan in terms of the bamboo forests. But due to the indiscretionary use of the land and the cutting of the bamboo forests, panda disappeared in that part of the world. So actually, you know, my friend at the Chinese Academy of Zoology or of Science in the Institute of Zoology provided me with the information. I was asking him, was there a panda in Yunnan province before they deforest the bamboo forests? And the answer was yes. There were actually, you know, remnants of panda. So clearly, it was a natural bamboo forest in many, many parts of Yunnan before human activities. And now we're trying to restore the bamboo forest. Now, of course, bamboo grows very fast. In 2 to 3 years, you can start to harvest the bamboo shoots. And the bamboo shoots, to give you a very interesting comparison, versus rice. If you cultivate rice, which, you know, you may have to spend many, many months cultivating rice, very labor intensive. And at the end, the rice will sell around maybe $1.60 renminbi and divide that by 5.5, so roughly a little about 30 cents Canadian dollars per kilo. If you sell bamboo shoots, you will get about $20 a kilo renminbi, so roughly $4 a kilo for Canadian dollars for per kilo of bamboo shoots. So if you can harvest bamboo shoots three or four times a year because it's regenerative and it's definitely sustainable and very little management.
You now have all these different departments from the University of Alberta standing ready to help. What are they doing?
Now, these scientists of different disciplines, expertise, would come at my invitation to China with us. And I introduced them to the scientists in China from the Chinese Academy of Forestry and also the Yunnan Academy of Forestry. And we worked together to look at the sites where soil loss is very severe and sensitive. How are we going to plant the trees? What trees to plant? What species? What kind of tolerance we need? How do we manage? How do we cultivate? How do we fertilize? How do we worry about fungicides, you know, insecticides? So in other words, a whole slew of scientific issues that we must resolve before we can start the planting.
What do you think the scientists from the University of Alberta are getting back from this? Are they learning much?
Yes, the scientists from the University of Alberta, they were actually quite impressed. They are not used to having to perhaps involved in an afforestation or a reforestation project in a remote part of the world that requires more than just planting trees, seedlings. I think the impression they got was that unlike, you know, tree planting in Canada, you cut, you know, forests and you plant seedlings, and that's that. Over there, before they can plant anything, they have to understand the not only the environmental impact in due course, but also the social economic impact. Would the planted trees be sustained? Or rather, they will be chopped down in 5 or 6 or 10 years because those people have no fuel. They have no electricity, no coal. They rely on timber for fuel and for heating. So how do you educate the local farmers, turn into foresters, to sustain their planting and to make a living out of that and then to protect that forever? So those are new issues and new challenges. And that's what I said earlier, that not only requires our forest expertise, but also rural socioeconomic expertise in order to incorporate that into the afforestation or reforestation projects.
Thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
That was Dr. Larry Wong, professor of biological sciences at the University of Alberta, and he's the president's advisor on international affairs. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. Check out our new website at innovationalberta.com. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, True North Energy, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, University of Lethbridge, Alberta Research Council, Alberta Conservation Association, and the Health Sciences Association of Alberta. Innovation Alberta is produced at Riverdale Recorders by Porcupine Stone Productions. I'm Cheryl Crocher.